First, let me start by saying thank you, David, for doing this. It's great. Here's an overview of my talk. And the good news is the only thing that stands between y'all and lunch is me. The bad news is I have like three talks worth of slides. So this is my way of telling you I'm going to go fast and I'm going to jump around. Because I have case study stuff and I also have metaphysics stuff, each of which could be a talk. So I'm trying to get through the whole arc, so I apologize for that in advance. Here are some relevant publications. My talks, the slides will be online somewhere, so you can, you know, look at them later if you're interested. But probably the most relevant one is the first one up there that's forthcoming about neural mechanisms. So a lot of this stuff comes from, there's this whole literature on mechanisms and neural mechanisms in particular, as you know. And myself and Tony Shimiro wrote this paper called Constraints on Localization and Decomposition, blah, blah, blah. That's the second version that I did there that's coming out. And anyway, we argue that localization and decomposition often fail in complex biological systems like the brain, which we drew a lot of fire for, some negative, some positive. That's the sort of stuff I'm going to talk about today. There's also, this book just came out in 2018. This is contextual emergence. I talk a lot about it in quantum mechanics, relativity. You can find that in this book. How about that cover, though, right? That came to me after a bout with ayahuasca. So I hope you like it. No one's laughing because they're like, yeah, he's probably saying those. I mean, it's open to interpretation. But yeah. No, actually, I'm kidding about everything I said except the ayahuasca part. That was painted by, I don't know if you know a philosopher named Tony Shimiro. His wife, Andrea, is a really great painter, and she painted that. And Oxford actually let us use it, which is kind of amazing. Okay, so let me start out by contextualizing some. What do I not want to do? I don't want to talk about weak emergence. I mean this in the sense of Vidal, for example. I think there are loads of those cases that are interesting. Not what I want to do. I'll come back to medium emergence in a second. I don't want to do strong emergence. Here I have, you know, like C.D. Broad's transordinal laws in mind, or O'Connor and Wong, those, you know, strong causal kind of emergence. Because it seems to me that if anything, only conscious experience would qualify for this, and I'm even skeptical about that. And certainly, so back to medium emergence. So the two things that I wrote about most when I began writing about emergence were in fact quantum entanglement and consciousness, but let me be clear, not together, separately. And the reason that I did that is because these struck me as, you know, real possible live cases of ontological emergence. So my thinking back then was that if these aren't cases, you know, nothing is. The problem with talking about quantum entanglement is people will say, do people who are not doing foundations of physics stuff will say, yeah, okay, quantum is weird, but so what else do you have? And then the problem obviously about talking about consciousness is kind of the same thing. Yeah, it's weird, but how does this apply to anything else? So I want cases that are not those. Here's my methodology. I call it science first. Start with empirical cases, and based on that, construct a provisional account of emergence. I see myself as doing Quinean naturalistic metaphysics, or, you know, good old fashioned, you know, naturalistic philosophy, attempt to read the ontology off our best scientific theories, discoveries, and activities. Needless to say, and by the way, every talk should have a self-contradictory statement, given the nature of human reasoning and under determination, my whatever metaphysical inferences I make are subject to being wrong. So what's my target? In the original paper that I was talking about in this newer paper, my target is old-school neo-mechanistic explanation in terms of localization and decomposition. So that sort of view implies the following. Components and mechanisms are always at a lower scale or level of analysis than the system that instantiates the mechanism itself. Functional explanation must ultimately be fully grounded in the most basic components of the mechanism and the interactions between them, and the interactions between the most basic components of the mechanism must be relatively insensitive to context. So why did I call that old school neo-mechanism? Because a number of people working in this sort of literature, like Bechtel and Richardson that Sandy mentioned, have sort of rejected that sort of kind of old school view, and they have a much more liberal conception of mechanisms now. But I want to make it clear with this slide, still the majority of people are not that liberal, so it's not that old. So just here's some quotes to make the point. Mechanisms as wholes do what they do because of the activity of the parts. The behavior of the wholes contain the behavior of the parts, and the behavior of the parts collectively and exhaustively constitute behavior of the whole. And the effects of context, organization, and constraints can all be accounted for in terms of the causal influences of lower level entities and activities. Obviously, I don't believe any of that. So I'm going to reverse my order of operations that I gave you on that slide, and I'm going to give you the definition of emergence first, and then we'll do cases just so the talk is more coherent. So what do I mean by contextual emergence? That's what I'm selling. I mean the following. Contextual emergence is a type of explanation that emphasizes the equal fundamentality of multi-scale contextual constraints and relations. Constraints that include global constraints, such as network topological properties, I'm going to talk about networks, and global organizing principles, such as, Sandy already did this for me, thank you, plasticity and robustness. She didn't talk about plasticity as such, but it's part of robustness and all that sort of stuff. And a lot of y'all probably already know that stuff. So contextual constraints are not merely inputs, boundary conditions, essential background conditions for mechanisms, etc. Contextual constraints can be symmetric, for example, such that X and Y can simultaneously act as contextual constraints. Contextual constraints can be causal mechanical. They can also involve more abstract kinds of causation. So in addition to the organizing constraints I talked about, they can involve non-causal, non-dynamical difference makers, such as conservation laws, free energy principles, least action principles, etc. So the point is, these sorts of constraints can be many different types of constraints. They don't need to be causal mechanical. And when you go to physics, you see a lot more of these sorts of constraints. I think they're in biology as well. You'll see why I think that. Contextual constraints, therefore, need not involve anything like direct causal mechanical or dynamical interactions. What constraints we're talking about are going to vary from case to case, explanation to explanation. They can be more or less concrete. So in physics, I'm going to say in biology too, sometimes the constraints are topological or dimensional. Think of universality classes, for example. Those are kinds of constraints. And contextual constraints can be behavioral, social, and normative. These contextual constraints represent both the screening off and the opening up of new areas of modal space, and thereby new and stable patterns emerge and become robust. I don't know why I highlighted that whole thing, but contextual emergence provides a framework to understand two things: A, how novel properties are produced, and B, why those properties matter. So contextual constraints modally create, constrain, and maintain systems. And again, modal talk here is pluralistic and subsumes all those things that I was talking about. So I'm an explanatory pluralist through and through. So case studies. I'm going to argue that systems biology and systems neuroscience contains robust, quote-unquote, mechanical, dynamical, and mathematical explanations of some phenomena that exhibit this kind of emergence and thus violate localization and decomposition. I don't have time to really do this for you. I could spend a whole talk doing, you know, graph theory and neuroscience or whatever, but a lot of you probably know the basic idea. There's this branch of systems neuroscience where we use network theory, and what we're interested in are the topological properties of these graphs. And more recently, we're trying to learn how to time evolve those graphs as well using dynamical systems theory. All that matters in these explanations is the topology, the pattern of connections, and obviously different geometries, arrangements of nodes and edges can instantiate the same topology. And we're interested in this across the brain as well as in specific areas in the brain. And I'll say more about this, but these network architectures are insensitive to and multiply realizable with respect to lower level neurochemical and wiring details. So I am, you know what a graph is. Again, sometimes we're interested in some specific area in the brain or brain activity. Sometimes the brain is open. A picture's worth a thousand words. So small world networks, C and D, they're different kinds of small world networks. But the important one for our purposes is the bottom right. So again, I'm not going to do the tutorial. The key topological properties of small world networks are a much higher clustering coefficient relative to random networks with equal numbers of nodes and edges and a short topological path length. That's what you just saw in that picture. So here, again, I could do a whole lecture on this slide, but this is just how this game is played. So you get yourself a brain to start with, and you see that those two arrows, right, you get some imaging data, you get some time series data, right, and then you can work out, obviously, you're using computer simulation and other sorts of tricks, but you can work out those structural brain networks, right, that's the stuff itself, okay, the physical stuff, and you can work out functional or topological brain networks, and you can try to figure out how those go together or not. So that's the game. So why do I say that this is a case of contextual emergence? Because topological explanations fail to be mechanistic because localization and decomposition fail. Why? How so? It's the fact that the difference, it is the fact that the difference-making topological properties, such as being a small world network, are global constraints that are relatively insensitive to their mechanistic implementation, such that the degree of small worldness is explanatory, i.e. counts as a difference maker, irrespective of the ever-changing structural details, which are often changing. Furthermore, why are such global network constraints so prevalent? That's the big question you want to ask yourself. Why are they so often multiply realized in complex biological and cognitive systems, even though the processes at smaller scales at other scales are happening on very different time scales? And there's often this rapid turnover of these entities and states involved in these networks. Here's my answer. It is because those global topological features, once in place, in turn constrain the behavior of the ever-changing constituents in order to maintain a relevant, efficacious topological constraint. So this doesn't look like anything like composition or realization, right? Although you might try to give that old, good old-fashioned, you know, it's just a bunch of different multiply realized things. We'll talk about that. So it is the self-maintenance and preservation of certain network structures that constrains the behavior of the parts, not just the other way around. So there's Carl's mutualism. As Sporn puts it, a reentrant system, he's a big connector, you probably know that, a reentrant system operates less as a hierarchy and more as a heterarchy, where super and subordinate levels are indistinct, most interactions are circular, and control is decentralized. These well-known philosophers of biology get it exactly right when they say, in contrast, design explanation proceeds in the opposite direction. As the functions to be performed explain the presence of some structural organization, not the other way around. Now, obviously, the amazing thing is, when human scientists play this game, they might start out in their computer simulations using a particular design setup. But nature does this, right? Without a designer, most of you will break it down, I'm guessing, or an engineer or anything like that. So these things are truly self-organized. So again, why do these things, why are they so multiply realized? It's not just because the nodes and edges in these networks need not refer to components and their relations directly, but because the behavior of the components is often determined or constrained by the global organization, in this case, small worldness. And I'm going to say the same thing about robustness and plasticity and those other organizational features. Those aren't local features, they're organizational global features of systems. So it's because network properties, or in the case of the dynamical case, order parameters, can represent or alter the global state of the system or some subset of it. So a topological feature is an organizational property of a mechanism if one can change the behavior of the mechanism as a whole by intervening to change the topological. So I want to be very clear about how I think that this is, why I think that this is, you can't escape the dynamicalness of these sorts of explanations. For any particular synchronic frame or still shot of a biological system at a time t with some duration d, the determining features include dichronic, dynamical, multi-scale interactions, call it context sensitivity, Sandy mentioned it as well, and global constraints outside the time slicing question. And these things can't even be assigned a scale or a level. Not that sort of thing. When it comes to such complex biological systems, one should take the word process very seriously and understand that these systems are spatially, temporally, functionally, and in a thin sense, theologically extended in space and time. I'll say more about why I think that's true. And again, notice that some of these dynamical constraints, these constraints affect dynamics, and they affect causal interaction, but they themselves can be adynamic, right? Again, just to give you an If small worldness seems like a weird thing for you to think about, Think about conservation laws of physics, right? We throw a constraint on the dynamics that they have to obey certain conservation laws. But they themselves are not dynamic. So, what I want to say is the focus on design principles and small worldness and their multiple realizability is symptomatic and not constitutive of the failure of localization and decomposition. So these aren't just artifacts of modeling. They're not just about representations. They're telling us something about the nature of these systems. And I'm trying to bring in the cavalry. So other people say the same. And therefore, I must be right. Because some of those people were scientists and don't know scientists. So speaking of, I am going to invoke these people, though, Levy and Bechtel, are exactly right when they say, quote, new tools such as graph theory, mathematical modeling, and dynamical systems theory provide holists with a research program that they previously lacked. Beyond merely criticizing extant mechanistic accounts for failing to take into account the context of the system in which the mechanisms operate, they can represent and analyze the behavior of complex systems. So I agree, right? But some people, as I was suggesting a second ago, some people in literature say, oh, look, graph theory, neuroscience, it's all just a mathematical game. You're not really getting at the components. You're not really getting at what matters mechanistically. And that's a big point. So we can ask ourselves that. Sandy's already done a lot of this work for me. I appreciate it. So let's can those cases for a second. Are there other cases in complex biological systems where you have contextual emergence? Yeah, textbook cases. And I'm going to quote a bunch of scientists to make the point. These are from textbooks. Right. So, epigenomics, I'm not going to go crazy with this by this. I'm sure we are all familiar with epigenomics at this point. But just to rehearse what we already know, the relationship between genes and proteins is many, many. And we must now think in terms of gene networks, RNA networks, and protein networks, and the complex nonlinear interactions between them. By the way, let me go back and say something in case somebody wants to make hay about this. In this case, nonlinearity is a big part of what's going on. And a lot of those, like in small world networks, those are linear. So the idea that this weirdness is all about being nonlinear or not is not true. Again, obviously, these interactions are at multiple scales. So further, these relationships are also affected by several contextual features, including cellular environment, the wider organismic environment, and various features of the external environment in which the organism is situated. So obviously, multi-scale, inextricably interrelated and interdependent. That's contextual emergence. So a couple more quotes. After the crisis of the gene-centric dogma of molecular biology quickly became evident that each characteristic, phenotypic characteristic, depends as much on the cellular functions that regulate expression of genomic information as on the functions that execute the underlying biochemical process. So in other words, the gene centrism that we used to believe in is no longer well justified. There is a unidirectional flow of information from one class of biological molecule to another. Genomic functions are inherently interactive. Isolated DNA is virtually inert. Cells have many mechanisms to complexify, modify, and change the structure and function of DNA. Genes can't do what they do without proteins, and the proteins are not free agents either. They respond to influences from across the rest of the organism and ultimately from the environment. Genes are controlled by proteins. Those proteins are coded for by other genes, and on and on and on. Genes, gene action are as much an effect as cause during protein synthesis, and genomic activity is as much effect as cause during cellular differentiation. It's important to understand here too, right? Don't think of that old, you know, like the genes are like the piano keys, and if, you know, it's just a matter of what's turned off and on. I mean, that's one way to think about epigenomics. Even when you pick a certain set of genes in a particular state, what they code for, what they do, is still going to be a complex nonlinear function of all this sort of stuff. So again, the idea that there's a genetic code, I would say, is just garbage. Others would disagree. So again, it should be clear that all this contextuality goes for protein folding and protein function as well. Amino acid sequences alone determine neither three-dimensional structure or function. You need a lot of other factors, including stuff that's going on in the cell. Nothing in the genome determines the topology of proteins. The biological information of proteins is not derived only from structural information, but from the complex functional networks that connect specific binding sites at the molecular level to the cell's activity and to the more global, organismic level of functioning. Embryogenesis, same story, is likewise not determined by the genome and also exemplifies contextuality. Early on in the embryo, evolve identical pluripotent cells become differentiated into various cell types and organs as a result of a network of physical and chemical environment gradients and signals. It is because such biological processes are so contextual and not driven by instructions from the genome that many call them self-assembling, self-organizing, and self-maintaining regulatory networks. So I guess I can not hit this one. How am I doing on time? 20 minutes? Okay. So, you already heard about robustness. So, I'll just give you an example of what Sandy was talking about. So, we can talk about plasticity, robustness, and autonomy. You probably heard these before. There's lots of different types. Probably everyone at least has heard about neuroplasticity because it makes the news so often. But it's also true for developmental, phenotypic, behavioral, immunological, and so on. So, let's just take an example. Phenotypic plasticity and robustness. This is the phenomenon in which genetically identical individuals will develop different phenotypic traits in different environment conditions because of phenotypic plasticity. A single genome or genome can produce many different genotype or genome can produce many different phenotypes depending on environmental and developmental contingencies. Robustness, as Sandy pointed out, has been illustrated by various knockout experiments. Phenotypic plasticity is just one example of epigenomic processes. In contrast, there are cases in which genetic or environmental changes have no phenotypic effect, and we call those robustness. Are these things really different? As Bateson and Gluckman know, robustness and plasticity are two sides of the same coin. They are interdependent. Indeed, plasticity is often regulated by robust mechanisms, and robustness is often generated by plastic mechanisms. And again, this is all textbook biology. What's the point? Plasticity, robustness, and autonomy are universal features of complex biological systems. Such global and systemic features are well known from a variety of different fields in biology. They've been well known for a long time. They're well confirmed, and this is not just a function of some abstract computer model that we have this information. What's the bigger point? Again, quoting here Noble, well known. From a systems level perspective, elements may be arranged in different ways, playing different roles, depending on context, organization, interactions. Same genes, different physiological function, depending on context. And again, the wider environment of the organism plays a key role. So what am I saying? I'm saying I think that biology reveals a world that looks more and more like a series of multi-scale, overlapping, inextricably connected, and interdependent heterogeneous contexts, say that three times fast, and constraints rather than a world of nearly decomposable modules or network motifs. In other words, I think the machine metaphor is ultimately not very important. I'm not saying it's useless or that it wasn't important, but ultimately. I believe that contextual emergence itself is the headline and not merely the mechanistic qualifier or mere background or initial conditions. I don't think this is going to go away as we get more clever about learning about these systems. It's not a function of ignorance, not merely a function of representation or models. So other people saying the same thing. So, metaphysics, I promised you some metaphysics. Let's get metaphysical. And I'm going to do that by talking about the mysteriousness problem. What could be more metaphysical than the mysteriousness problem, right? So, what is it? Well, here's what it is. Here's Winning and Bechtel. Again, we have Bechtel, Jason Winning. In a nutshell, the problem is this. Why do complex biological and cognitive processes so reliably exhibit and maintain the order and stability that we just learned about that they do? Or if you prefer, what metaphysically grounds the causal powers and causal mechanisms? So, there you go, right? Here's their answer. We argue that the conceptual lexicon of science does have the resources to solve it, and guess what? We're going to say constraint. So that should sound familiar, because that's the story that I've been selling. By the way, if you know Bill Bechtel, then you know how absolutely weird it is that he would go into the territory of metaphysics. But okay, he did it. Or maybe Jason didn't help him. What is their claim? In short, constraints ground causal powers. A causal mechanism is just a certain spatiotemporal organization plus its various constraints. For example, a cell membrane, lots of the other things I talked about as well. By means of possessing such emergent powers, mechanisms, proponents, cause and produce the effects they do. They also emphasize that a lot of these things are global, like plasticity, robustness, network properties, and so on. They talk about time-dependent variable constraints in particular. And here's what Bechtel says. I reconceptualize mechanisms as imposing constraints on flows of free energy with control mechanisms operating on flexible constraints in primary mechanisms. So are they talking about the same thing that I am? Well, they say a lot of the same things, and I think there's certainly plenty of overlap. So they say, thus, in our view, when constraints enable objects to have novel emergent behaviors, this is tantamount to the emergence of causal power. Well, there you go. And they say, the framework of constraints can be applied iteratively. A macro-scale object can be further constrained by incorporating it into a larger-scale object. By restricting degrees of freedom of its components, and thereby enabling the whole mechanism to do things that would otherwise not be possible. Okay. And they even, it's interesting, those of you who follow the literature, the battle in neuroscience and cognitive science between the extended and activist embodied cognition people and the representationalists, the extended and active people often use the metaphor for the brain as a control mechanism. So you should think about the brain as some sort of, you know, it's something that coordinates action and perception and various other things, rather than some sort of, you know, representational device. And here you see Bechtel using this metaphor. It's a big deal. So Winning is even more explicit about his metaphysical commitments. He posits constraints as ontologically primitive modal structure and conceives of constraints as powers, which are intrinsic dispositions. He makes it very clear what he means by intrinsic is that he thinks they exist even when they're not manifested. As he puts it, these things are the truth makers for dynamical equations and modal causal claims. So the point is that for Winning, it is such constraints that grant the causal efficacy or causal powers of mechanisms as a whole. Clearly, he would say it's true about dynamical laws as well. So what is he selling here, right? I'm doing this metaphysics. Getting to my own metaphysical conclusion. He's selling what Dorado calls dispositionalism, the view that properties are intrinsic dispositions in the sense that objects, entities, and systems have no intrinsic powers except for dispositional properties. Objects, et cetera, have intrinsic dispositions to interact with intrinsic dispositions of other objects in a symmetric fashion. Why do we call them intrinsic? Once again, they can exist unmanifested in this world, and to use the lingo of many worlds, they could exist in a possible world in which only they alone exist. That's one way to define intrinsic. Nobody knows how to define intrinsic. That's one way that metaphysicians do. So let's put a pin in that. I'm going to come back to dispositions in a second. Let me bring it back to mechanisms. So I'm astounded and gratified and confused that what I call contextual emergence and something similar that certain arch mechanists call mechanistic constraints appear to be on the road to convergence and rapprochement. I like to call Bill an arch mechanist because he's a mom. But I don't do it just to make him mad. I do it because he really is, he and other people like him, Richardson and a few others, I cannot understate enough how much these people really learn their shit, right? These people really know the brain and they really know biology. So it's something to think about when you think about the sort of things that they're saying. So, explanatory differences aside, I do have metaphysical difference with them. I have a lot of differences with them. They only focus on causal mechanical constraints. There's a lot of other things I could say. But let me go back to the metaphysics where I differ from them. And I'm going to do it by coming back to this. Where do order and stability come from? I think that's what we're all interested in. Whether you think of yourself as primarily a philosopher of science or a metaphysician or some combination of both, probably most of us do. I think this is the question we're all trying to answer. Where do order and stability come from? Right? So one way to ask the question, one possible hypothesis, is there some sort of extra physical, metaphysical, modal, nomological, causal glue or necessity in the world that resolves the grounding or mysteriousness problem? It seems like you either answer yes or no. If you answer yes, you're some version of non-Humean. If you answer no, you're some version of a Humean. I know I'm running a lot. There's a lot of different views in those categories, and I'm not going to go into it all. But the question you got to ask yourself is that exhaustive, right? In other words, are we really stuck with either extra scientific glue or just Humean patterns? I think most of us probably want something else. We don't want to be stuck with those things. So let's bring it back to mechanisms, as I said I would do. So here's the debate. McNamara and others claims that it is mechanisms themselves, construed as activities, don't ask me what that means, that answers the metaphysical grounding question. Order and stability exist in biological systems because of causal mechanisms. On his Humean view, any appeal to anything as metaphysical as powers is mysterious and unnatural. Whereas now, Whitting and Bechtel argue the reverse. They want to explain the causal powers of mechanisms by invoking constraints as intrinsic dispositions. They would say merely appealing to the activities or the phenomenon itself explains nothing. So there's the debate. Obviously, this same debate, you find it about law, you find it about everything. So this then is a dispute about which facts are the brutest facts, activities or constraints. Or if you prefer, it's a dispute about what ultimately counts as explanans and explanandum. So again, is there a third way? I'm deeply suspicious of the idea that order requires any extra physical, extra scientific, metaphysical glue. To me, it seems like a Platonic holdover. Yet I agree humanism is largely unsatisfactory. But I think the very idea of an intrinsic disposition is an oxymoron. The idea that such things exist unmanifested, that they could exist in a possible world where no other entities or components are there to trigger them, just strikes me as a contradiction. But it doesn't mean that I want some other external glue. So there is an alternative within metaphysics. So Alex Kareth has perfectly captured what ontological contextual emergence is claiming. So here I'm saying I think there is a convergence of a particular school of metaphysics and what I think science is telling us about the nature of reality. The model proposed by Martin Heil then does not encourage us to think of powers as isolated, but rather as participating in a network or web of potency, dispositionality. The model here is not a chain, but a net. Start with any dispositional partner, and you find a network, a power net. Every disposition is, in this way, a holistic web, but not just an amorphous spread of potency. I have no idea what that means. And every power or disposition, it sounds like porn to me. And every power or disposition, an ineliminable reference to the infinity of potential partners inherent. There you go. So is there another way? Yes. And again, I think it's the key to the very possibility of ontological emergence. So here's from my point of view, the most important ontological take-home message that I have. Where do order and stability come from, you ask? Order and stability exist because contextual emergence is the fundamental nature of the universe, not an add-on. In metaphysical parlance, this is a rejection of the hierarchy or foundationalism thesis. Relations at various scales aren't anti-symmetric, transitive, or anti-reflexive. It's also a rejection of the very idea of intrinsic properties or primitive thisness. I think Paul called this hiacity, or I know there's a lot of words for it. And by the way, if you look in the book edited by Bliss and Priest, you can now find a whole book of metaphysicians who are dealing with this particular view. So this is something that metaphysicians are struggling with in their own right, apart from philosophy of science. This view ultimately engenders a self-referential model of explanation that is neither foundationalist or dappled. So again, I don't like the foundationalist picture. I mean that metaphysically in this case, right? And I also don't like the dappled picture. I mean, it strikes me that the world is more unified than that, but not unified in terms of ontological reduction. I think this view offers a middle way. And so the idea, again, dispositions are extrinsic. This is the real key to answering the grounding problem, right? Where am I at time-wise? I have 10 minutes for my questions, Ian. Or it left in my talk. Okay. So obviously, time is going way quicker for me than it is. That's the nature of being here. So. Weird, right? By the way, it's great to look out and see so many hungover people and know that it isn't me this time. Yeah. So is there another way? When you imagine that the world at bottom is just some physical entity, particles, fields, waves, quantum loops, membranes, pick your poison, whose states of time evolve by some dynamical law, then it's easy to see why you would feel the need for extra scientific glue. Because, you know, absurd analogies about the game of life and finite automata aside, you really should have a real worry. How is it that those physical processes would lead to the world that we live in? But perhaps the question, where do order and stability come from, was motivated by bad models of the nature of reality to begin with. Unlike the strong causal emergence of conscious experience or the weirdness of quantum entanglement, ontological contextual emergence isn't some rare, weird shit. Ontological contextual emergence is common, universal, non-spooky, doesn't defy scientific explanation. We've seen that the biological sciences are full of it. I think physics is full of it as well. I think it's the nature of reality. And this is, again, right, this is why emergence is possible. This is why it's not weird or rare or doesn't require things popping into being based on, you know, laws that we can't explain. So I'm not going to go into this at any length, but C.D. Broad, I'm certainly rejecting his transordinal laws, but I think if you understand C.D. Broad correctly, the story goes like this. Why does he think that there are these, there's this unpredictability in principle as regards to these transordinal laws? I think the right way to read C.D. Broad is because he thinks that contextuality, right? Exactly what I'm trying to say. That's where it comes from. Not something that just magically pops into existence. And he says things that I think support what I'm saying. According to Broad, this is the view, laws governing the parts of a system operate in a purely context-independent fashion. That's what he was fighting against. That particular brand of pure mechanism is what he called it. So what does Broad say? Global constraints and other kinds of context sensitivities, he puts it, an emergent quality is roughly a quality which belongs to a complex as a whole and not to its parts, not given by the properties of the basic parts in isolation. So I think Broad is very much getting at the same thing. What's my point? We don't need transordinal laws plus ontological contextual emergence. We just need ontological contextual emergence. And you're going to get the laws right out of that. You don't need to add any other mojo to the world to make emergence happen. So we all know, Sandy was just talking about this, many accounts of laws, modalities, and dispositions are driven by concerns about the nature, essence of laws versus non-laws, realism about laws, distinguishing non-logical claims from causal claims, and so on. That is a huge body of literature in philosophy of science and it still exists. I think those are not the right or interesting questions to ask at the end of the day. They don't see us, they don't help us see what science is really telling us about the nature of reality. Ontological contextual emergence represents a pluralism, both about laws of causation, that defies any essentialism about them. And I think the game of cooking up essences and necessary conditions and sufficient conditions for laws and causes and all that is largely bankrupt. So what are laws then? Where is this, what is this order I'm talking about? Laws are simply patterns and property compatibility relations that can either be widespread or very specific, and either strong or relatively weak. The fact that they are strong or weak partly reflects how sensitive the property compatibility relations are to changes in contextual mediators. The fact that they are widespread or narrow simply reflects how commonly those properties must be compatible or incompatible or produced. So, yes, of course, fundamental physical laws are more universal. That doesn't mean that they're more fundamental in any other way, right? That just means they are necessary conditions. They subsume the largest number of phenomena. That's the only sense in which they're fundamental. So they may form necessary conditions or constraints for what is to follow. So, just as Paul suggested, ontological contextual emergence implies laws are emergent. Laws will come into being and pass away over time as contexts arise and change. A new law may be born within the previously given context that real laws and constraints would be no more fundamental in any absolute sense than any new laws. And in turn, these newly emergent laws could contribute necessary conditions for the birth of still more subsequently emergent laws. In this way, there would be a complex nesting of necessary and sufficient conditions among laws and constraints. So, on this view, even natural necessity is a contextual feature of reality. And that's, so what I'm saying is all laws are constraints. The constraints are different, and this way of thinking changes everything. So the old distinction between the dynamical laws that evolve systems versus their initial conditions becomes problematic. Because remember, on this view, laws don't govern things, right? There's not some magical platonic dynamical equation that tells stuff how to move around. And we don't need to think about dynamic laws and conservation laws as being nearly so distinct as we used to as well. Again, it's all just constraints. So imagine, right? You just keep putting these filters on. And they're going to be filters, multi-scale, all some more subsumptive than others. And again, it's important to keep in mind that these filters don't just constrain degrees of freedom. They because reality is inherently contextual, they open up other degrees of freedom as well. That's important. So this my last slide here is I'm going to try to out metaphysics, you know, do more metaphysics than even the metaphysicians. I'm trying to freak out and free. So here you go, Buddhist metaphysics. What am I really saying? Something that Nagarjuna said a long time ago, something that is not dependently arisen, such a thing does not exist.